This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Joining us now is Camilla Thrush. She works for the Olympic Delivery Authority, which has been mentioned several times already this morning. She's led strategic projects in diversity and inclusion for the public sector. She's worked with government departments, such as the Office for Disability Issues. She's done a lot of work in this area. I'm going to ask Camilla to introduce herself just for a couple of minutes, and then we're going to take all of your questions. So, Camilla, if you could just tell us a little bit. Thank you.
I don't want to take up too much time, so I'd quite like to get into the panel discussion, but I just wanted to run through a few things that particularly we've been trying to address at London 2012 and the Olympic Delivery Authority. New opportunities and new challenges. Obviously, they include the need to ensure that leadership leads from the front, but what we've found is that it's leadership across all areas. I think it's already been discussed quite a lot today. It's not just your HR areas or your procurement or your legal. It's across all areas in the organisation. I think the challenges faced by the public bodies delivering services and programmes in conjunction with commercial or private sector are huge. We have responsibilities to obviously ensuring statutory duties are met and where possible exceeded. But they need to be understood and delivered in relation to the work programme by everybody. Understanding and addressing the impact of the programme, not only from an equality and inclusion standpoint, but alongside other competing priorities, such as sustainability, health and safety, security. All of this in addition to the usual private commercial sector's need for things to be on time, on budget and fit for purpose. The programme of services really needs to understand, reflect and deliver what the community needs. It needs to understand an effective way of communicating with those groups who in the past may have been described as hard to reach. Getting the private sector to understand that is more than just their corporate social responsibility programmes that they might have in place. Ensuring the procurement, which we've already spoken about, includes equality and inclusion requirements and is scored as highly as any other requirement of that process. Is something that we've pushed very hard for at the ODA. But not only that, that when the contract is awarded, there is actually a requirement within the contract to deliver equality and inclusion through leadership, through understanding, but also through the way they select their supply chain as well, the way they monitor their staff, the way they actually introduce new policies and practices. We work to encourage the contractors to diversify their supply chain, In order to spread the benefits of things like the Games to minority-owned businesses and SMEs. We look for meaningful ways to enable sustainable employment. The Games 2012, actually the Olympic Delivery Authority will virtually cease to exist in 2011. And it's no point in us training people up just to do the Games. There's so many more construction projects and programmes that are running in the East End of London, so it's important that we look at sustainable employment and that we work with partnerships, training bodies, to ensure that actually we understand what the needs are of the community and to ensure that we're actually training people in professions and jobs that mean they can go out and then find further employment and start to address that socioeconomic deprivation in the areas that we're working. That's just a very small overview of some of the things we've been trying to do with our commercial partners. We have in total over 20 Tier 1 contractors. So that's 20 different organisations that we're working with to ensure that they understand the requirements of embedding equality and inclusion into their practice as well. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Camilla. Right, now, it's your turn. There are microphones. I think we have our two roving microphone holders there. When you ask a question, could you, as per usual, say who you are and what organisation you're from and who you'd like on the panel to answer your question? You might want to hear from everybody, but if there's someone specific that you're addressing the question to, please let us know. Put your hands up. I will try and pick people if I don't see you and you feel hard done by, shout and wave a lot. So, questions. Who would like to start us off? Right. Woman there in, I think, green. Yes. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Hall from North Yorkshire Police. My day job is a lawyer, but I've just been asked to refresh our diversity unit. So I'm getting to grips, hopefully very quickly, with equality and diversity issues. But my question really is for Amanda. Amanda, we were talking about the law just being a sort of regulatory tool. Have you sort of any ideas on how it could be used more creatively to get this climate of commitment in work practice?
Thank you. Amanda?
Do you want to take that, or do you want to take
I'll just take one at a time, I think, for now.
Okay. Well, I think this is easier to do in the public sector, where you are, than it is in the private sector, because, of course, in the public sector, you've got a positive duty on bodies to take steps to eliminate discrimination, to advance equality of opportunity, and to foster good relations between different parts of the community. So you've got something there that's very values-driven about what the public sector should be about, that it's not a sort of neutral arbiter, if you like, but that the public sector has got a specific role, if you were putting it in grand terms, to make the world a better place by not just, avoiding making things worse, but having a duty to close some of the inequality gaps that exist between different communities and to get rid of unlawful discrimination and harassment, as well as to take active steps to improve relationships between different groups in society across a very wide range of grounds. So I think just within the law, that's a tool that can be used very creatively and very positively to engage the leadership of an organisation in thinking about equality and diversity as part of its vision for how it does every single thing it does. And there's some really interesting examples in policing, I think. If you've got somebody like Hugh Orde saying that he took a human rights approach to policing in Northern Ireland, well, obviously much has changed in Northern Ireland and very much for the better in the last 10 years, but most people would see policing Northern Ireland as a fairly tough call, not an easy thing to do at all. And here's somebody who said, we took a human rights approach to policing parades, one of the flashpoints of difficulty in that community, and it worked. So I think there are some real opportunities for people in the public sector to learn from those examples of people making it work in very difficult situations, but also from using the public sector duty in particular as something that can be quite visionary, quite liberating, quite exciting. Of course, if you do it wrong, the public sector just becomes a monstrous paper chase. What's really important, I think, is for organisations to hold on to the core ideas that it's not about producing tremendously long documents, it's about thinking creatively about where are the biggest inequalities facing the community you're serving and what can your organisation do to challenge them, and thinking about how every time a decision is made, really thinking, does this decision or policy or whatever it is we're deciding about, will it have a beneficial effect for people who are facing inequality? If not, what can we do to make sure it does? And looking at it more negatively, will it have a detrimental effect for any group that faces inequality? And if it might, make sure it doesn't, change how you're going to do something to get rid of that effect. So the core ideas of the public sector equality duty are very simple, and I think they're capable of being really very exciting ones. And there's a lot of advice available from organisations like Angela's and their sort of sister bodies in other sectors about how to do that.
Any other members of the panel like to add something? Jane?
Angela.
Well, I mean, you've got your exciting new equality standard and the new equality and human rights strategy, national equality and human rights strategy for police services. So you've got a lot to be working with. But I think the message is terribly important. So when we did the equality framework for local government and changed from the standard, we used a new definition of equality. We used the definition of equality, which was in something called the Equalities Review, which was some time ago now. But it's definition of equality, which is really, it is based on human rights principles. It's about the life chances of people in all sorts of different areas. And by talking about fairness and equal life chances, it's made an enormous difference, because suddenly the whole agenda becomes accessible. So it's about everyone. So if you're in local government, if you're in the police, you know, have to be concerned with everybody's life chances. And it takes it away from being seen as rather sectional and only to do with minorities, although women aren't a minority, and sort of brings it into the general public domain. And I noticed that I was rather pleased in the foreword to your new police standard. Because we work quite closely with them, they've used that wider notion of equality. So I think those sort of messages are really important.
I suppose the only thing that I was thinking is there was reference to the values that underpin the public sector, and that's absolutely right. Also, of course, lots of private companies have values too, and the public sector are in a position to make sure that they do business with companies that not only have the values but live the values. And we're always talking about, well, living, it's important, isn't it, to recruit the best possible people you can get your hands on. That means taking account of equality and diversity. If you're wanting to retain the best people, that means taking account of equality and diversity. And I can't think of one area of any organisational life that can't be equalitised. It's a good verb, isn't it?
No. Thank you very much. Camilla, did you want to add anything, or shall we take some more questions?
You would.
Right. Any more questions? Man there. Any others, if I can batch, if... No? Right, we'll go with you. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Ibrahim Ali. My question is not designed for any specific person. I'm just asking the whole panel.
Thank you.
And my question is coming from in relation to the housing situation in London. As you know, the government has introduced a policy called choice-based letting policy over the last 3 years. And some specific communities are saying to us that they're not accessing. Although they are bidding the housing, they are not accessing the house. So they feel they are either barriers or kind of discrimination within the system. So my question is generally like that. For example, if a specific community are not accessing what public is accessing, then what is the question? What is the solution for that?
Thank you. I'll start with Camilla.
Yeah. Okay. I'd just like to sort of answer that in a various way. As part of the development work for the Olympic Park, there is housing, as everyone knows, on the Olympic Park. But what we actually did along with the LDA was went out to find out what type of housing was actually needed in the area. Because with most new developments, the builders want to look at apartments, 1-2-bedroom apartments. That's not what was needed in the East End of London. So we actually made a commitment to building housing that's for families, large families, where they can live together, looking at communities where you can actually create a community housing situation. And that starts to address some of those issues that you're referring to, where people feel they're excluded from the housing stock. So that's one way of actually looking at how you include people in that process, is you go out and ask them what it is they need, and then you actually design to that need, as opposed to following maybe the standard way of building houses and housing. Ensuring that you have social housing built within a block where you can't actually tell which is which, because I think most people, when they look at housing blocks, can pick out the social housing and the private housing quite easily. But when you actually embed it into the whole block, you can't see it. So you're actually saying to people, you're all equal in this housing, and we're actually going to provide for your needs. We're going to provide for the family.
Thank you. I'm not going to force every panel member to answer every question, but Jane, would you like to add anything?
Well, just briefly, I think it raises the really important issue around making sure that the data is available and monitored and used. So again, back to that question around who gets what and a sophisticated analysis of that. And then the patterns can be identified, then the housing associations and different public bodies can be properly held to account for looking at their criteria and their allocation procedures.
Thank you. Angela?
Well, I very much agree with that. Although, when you asked the question, it reminded me when people will know that in Barking and Dagenham, 11 BNP councillors were elected a few years ago. And just after that happened, I went to a seminar which was addressed by the chief executive of Barking in Dagenham. And he said, I can't remember the exact figures, but he said 15, 20 years ago in Barking in Dagenham, we had 50,000 units, 20% of them were four bed. Today we have 15,000 units, no four beds. And I think your question illustrates the point that various of us were making about the importance of socioeconomic factors. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, the terrible crisis, in there is not enough social housing. There's just not enough. And equality, different equality protected groups.
Thank you. Amanda?
I don't think I have anything to add to what colleagues have already said.
Woman there, and a man there.
Yes, my name's Jane Sharp. I work for Rural Partnership Homes, and we're wrestling with a similar issue. Our BME community is very small, just outside Liverpool on the Wirral Peninsula. The barriers we've identified, or in the process of identifying, is a process one, in that the people that get awarded the properties are the people that have been on the registered longest, and that seems to be a weakness in the current system that favours existing communities and disadvantages new people moving into that area. So I just wanted to share that with people. If anyone's got any other ideas, we'd love to talk to them over the networking sessions. We're here.
Thank you. Yes, I hope we will make use of the networking sessions later. We can all talk to each other. Man here on the middle table. Wave at the microphone. Good.
Mark Lomas from Shaw Trust. I heard the panel talking about the procurement provisions and also the socioeconomic element. One thing that's become clear to us at Shaw Trust is that local government and indeed some larger government departments have a very poor understanding of supplier diversity. And do you think that a specific duty on supplier diversity within the procurement elements of the bill would help discharge the socioeconomic element if that doesn't make it through?
Thank you. That's a very interesting question, because I think that part of the bill is going to be absolutely crucial, and let's hope it is part of the bill and part of the Act. Who would like to start? Does anybody have strong views? Shall I start at this end? Amanda, do you have anything you want to say on that one?
I'm happy to respond. It's a very interesting question, Mark. Thank you for raising that point. I mean, I think where the bill is, simply in terms of parliamentary process, it's got to the point where it's going to be quite difficult to introduce significant new issues simply because of the time pressure. If the bill doesn't actually become law by the 24th of April, it automatically falls. And the way that Parliament works with the recesses and so on, and the limits on the number of sitting days, the time available to get it through is now quite short. So I'm wishing you'd... I'd had this thought some while ago, because I think realistically it will be very difficult to get something along those lines actually into the bill. So it may be a question of actually thinking about what are the other channels, for thinking about how that very important point could be raised, which is probably going to be around the guidance that is produced by the Equality and Human Rights Commission. I think Alan Christie from the Commission is going to be here this afternoon, so... and he's got a particular interest in the private sector, so nobble him and raise this point with him. Because the wider point you raise is that there is a huge lack of understanding amongst many people in the public sector who are responsible for procurement about what they can do. People have been much too cautious. They've been, and government, I think, have actually until very recently failed to give anything like a lead on this. That the Office for Government Commerce has been allowed to run around the place saying this isn't very important, or you're not allowed to because European law prevents it. It's only very recently we've had any guidance from central government that's encouraged public bodies to see equality as an important part of procurement. So it's been left to the people like the like Camilla and her colleagues and Transport for London and then those in the public sector who've really been committed to show what can be done, because already the law allows a great deal to be done, and in our view actually requires, but it's already... the existing public duties require public bodies to address equality in procurement. So I'm not sure that's a direct answer to your question, except to say I think it's very difficult in logistical terms, but it's a great idea. So let's think about other ways of encouraging public bodies to be much more creative about what they're doing around supplier diversity, and for everybody to adopt the best practice that already a few have trailblazed.
Thank you. I'm going to swap over to Jane, and then we'll ask Angela and Camilla.
I think it is really interesting, and it's really difficult, I think, to crack it. So there's we do need to focus on it. I think that there are some great there has been some great work by Olympic to the Royal Authority, Transport for London, and other public bodies around supplier diversity. I was in a large construction company a couple of weeks ago, and the director of business development of that company said, "Well, it's all very well, Jane, but you know, actually, we've got this huge project to do. And how is it that we're meant to be going around the East End of London? And various areas of Birmingham where they're also doing large infrastructure projects, kind of trying to get SME companies, BME-owned companies, women-owned companies. How logistically that is just not going to happen in the very tight time frames and so on." And so, as ever, my challenge back to him was, well, what can you do? What are the steps that you can take? Yes, you can't do that overnight, but you can build relationships over 3, 5, 7, 10 years with SMEs, and you can pull them in to your company and talk about what you require and so on. And then in some years' time, it will be different. But it's something about making a start and again, getting these examples of good practice better known and understood.
Thank you. Camilla next. Large projects, can it be done overnight?
It can be done. It can be done with large projects with very tight timescales. I think the important thing is that the public body has a responsibility to actually ensure that, A, we raise expectations in the right way, because as you can imagine, we've most probably had every single business in the country coming to us saying we could do something for you. But also that we then get the right businesses talking to the right private sector. So we bring them together. We do meet the buyer events. We do events where we hire rooms like this. And we actually say to the contractors, here is someone who is down the road, who is an SME, who can actually supply what you need. What are you going to do to actually take this on? And how are you going to work with these people and these businesses to ensure that actually you do start to include them into your supply chain? Because you will have large construction companies that already have a supply chain in place. The challenge for the public sector is to say, yes, you can go to your established supply chain, but you also need to be open and ready to work with others as well, and to build that into the contract. Again, the contract, for me, is most probably the most important thing. The procurement process itself, great, but if the contract that then follows doesn't actually require you to do anything, what's the point of the questions in the procurement process? So for me, it's you build it into the contract and you work with the organisation to open their eyes to the possibility, and then they will take things on board. And they will then start to address the socioeconomic deprivation in the areas that they're working in.
Thank you. Angela?
That was a very good point Camilla made. If I can take a little bit of credit for the procurement provisions in the bill, we did a very big survey amongst all local government procurement officers, a little-known group, a rather dry group. Anyway, the result, it was the biggest survey I think has ever been done, and the result of the survey was that they all said that they wanted to do stuff on equality issues, And the problem was the lack of clarity, the legal uncertainty, and the lack of guidance. And I think that the Government Equality Office, I've got Jonathan coming later, used that quite a lot. That was the best bit of evidence they had for trying to trump the Office of Government Commerce, who didn't want to do anything at all, and introducing the provisions in the bill. And I think, as everybody said, they are really, really important provisions. Now, Amanda's right, there's not going to be any amendments at this stage. So the crucial thing is the guidance. And obviously the HRC will write guidance, but I'm very keen on the idea that different parts of the public sector also write their own guidance, because that's what people are going to actually listen to. And that's one of the next big projects that we have at IDA. And we will make those points about the contract and about supplier diversity. And also, I think, say, well, it's not all going to magically happen. Local government and partners have a real role here in bringing people together. And I would see that as quite an essential function of local government and a key equality priority in the period coming forward.
Thank you. Are there any... Right, we take one more man here. Have I ignored anybody who's been putting their hand up all morning? No, good. One piece here. If you could make it fairly short, otherwise we won't get coffee.
It will be short and sweet, thank you. Amarabati Wakefield Council. Angela, you welcome generic approach towards equality for all. But my question is, what do you think the chances are for the key equality strands getting diluted in the process?
I'm often asked about that. And I think I'm fairly confident that that's not going to happen. I mean, I think the situation at the moment is that some equality standards, if you take gender, which has been around for ages and ages and ages, but if you look at, I would say, local government's performance on gender, it's pretty poor, actually. So that couldn't, in a sense, get worse. I think the big fear is around race, in a way. And race has become a more complex issue with sort of super diversity, churn, migration, all these sort of issues. And it may be that, I mean, I'm just saying this off the top of my head, perhaps in another foolhardy way, but it may be that sort of our whole thinking about race and diversity requires a big refresh about what our... you know, the key issues that have to be addressed. It's quite interesting in relation to sexual orientation that although we had Section 28 for so long, local authorities haven't really, I think, had major problems about dealing with sexual orientation. But I do think there are, and I know we'll have sessions on this later, issues. I don't think people understand religion or belief, what that actually means. Mm-hmm. And how that interconnects, particularly with issues of race and ethnicity. But I think the sort of freeing of ourselves from sort of the tyranny of the different sections does create a much more open and stimulating atmosphere in which to think about the specific issues faced by different groups in our community. So I think that answer's optimistic and probably foolhardy, but there you go.
We like optimism. Thank you very much. I'm going to wind up this session now. Thank you very much to our speakers and panellists. They can't actually go yet because, as you will see, Jane and Angela are going to lead some of our seminars now. They're going to be joined by Sarah Veal, Fiona Edwards and Barney Leith. Pick your seminars along that corridor, but before that, do have coffee and talk to each other, please. After the seminars, it will be lunch, so we'll see you there. Thank you very much.